just having that sense of community and feeling safe. As an educator, I think that's very important, regardless of where you're from. And it starts with sharing my story.
A lot of my teachers were just English speakers, and they lived in the suburbs, and they had the more common childhood, and I was never able to relate or have that safe space to talk about my childhood.
There's an image that comes up when you think of an undocumented person, and the truth of the matter is it is widely diverse, and that narrative serves a purpose.
The book argues for an approach to listening to children because their narratives matter. Hello, and thank you for being here. My name is Ariana Mangual Figueroa. I'm an associate professor at the CUNY City University of New York Graduate Center in two PhD programs in urban education and in LALAC, which is Latin American, Iberian, and Latino cultures. I'm also a co-principal investigator at the CUNY Initiative on Immigration and Education, and I'm now also the author of Knowing Silence, How Children Talk About Immigration Status at School. I'm a Puerto Rican woman, professor, teacher, mother, born and raised in New York City with a conciencia, an awareness, personal and political, that Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, that our citizenship is born out of that and remains second class, and that having an imagination of independence from that colonial status is both complex and important. Prior to becoming a professor, I was a New York City public school teacher, and I obtained my PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. My experiences growing up in New York City as a child, as a teacher, my experiences traveling throughout the country as a researcher and scholar have really led to this pan-Latinx conciencia, once again, an awareness of the ways in which immigration status shaped the everyday lives of Latinx people living in the United States today. And so it is this awareness, this interest, this curiosity as to how immigration status shapes the lives of children that led me to write this book, Knowing Silence. And it is this interest, this conversation that brings me together today with three interlocutors who I admire deeply. Lumari, a student at the heart of this project, Claudia, an elementary school teacher and mentor to the students in this project, and Aurora, an educational researcher whose theorization of citizenship status and whose concept of hyperdocumentation has been very important to my work and to this book. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Ariana. My name is Dr. Aurora Chang, and I'm a once undocumented Guatemalan immigrant turned, as Ariana said, hyperdocumented professor. I'm also the founder of Academic Life Simplified, where I help academics write with power, compassion, and authenticity. I'm a graduate of UC Berkeley, Stanford, and the University of Texas at Austin. And there I earned my doctoral degree in curriculum and instruction and cultural studies. And I've been an educator in different contexts for the past 25 years. Before assuming my role as a CEO of Academic Life Simplified, I was the director of faculty development at George Mason University, and I was also an associate professor at Loyola University and a bunch of other jobs that spanned from Wyoming to Wisconsin to Austin to New York and Berkeley. And my research centers on the intersection of education, identity, and agency within traditionally marginalized communities. And one of the strands of my research is on the educational experiences of those who are undocumented, particularly Latinx students. And I'm thrilled to be here.
Hi, everyone. My name is Claudia Rolando, and I am an undocumented teacher currently under DACA. I'm an educator. I graduated from Brooklyn College, and I'm currently teaching third grade. Yeah.
Hello, everyone. My name is Lumari Sosa Garzon. I am an undocumented student in New York. I'm a junior at the Macaulay Honors Program. I'm based in Brooklyn College, and I'm also part of the National Scholarship of the Dream US. And I'm very excited to be here as a student, and I have been able to work with many of us here.
Well, it's an honor to have all of you here today. Thank you for sharing of yourself and introducing yourself to our listeners. I wanted to define a few key terms that are at the core of this book, Knowing Silence, and at the core of, in a way, implied in the introductions that you've shared with us today. And then we'll go on to some storytelling and some conversation about some of the core themes of the book. So mixed status families are really at the heart of this ethnography. And I use demographers Michael Fix and Wendy Zimmerman's 2001 definition of a mixed status family. That is one kind of immigrant family that, quote, may be made up of any combination of legal immigrants, undocumented immigrants, and naturalized citizens. Their composition also changes frequently as undocumented family members legalize their status and legal immigrants naturalize, end quote. So at the core of this book are families within which have a tremendous amount of diversity. From the perspective of schools, we tend to think of families as fairly homogenous. They speak the same home language or they have the same country of origin. But in fact, mixed status families illuminate for us the diversity that exists within Latinx families living in the United States and immigrant families beyond Latinx as well. And so within these families, there can be members who are undocumented, members who are in a process of obtaining or losing an immigration status related to the United States. And there may be ones who were born in this country and who are US-born citizens. Now, within mixed status families, children are at the heart of this project. And so I focus on children in middle childhood, the period from 6 to 12 years of age, which has been by some scholars referred to as the forgotten years of development, because most research is focused on early childhood development or adolescent growth. And it's the population of children that it's important for us to understand because they are in first, second, third grade, and they are children who are making sense of the realities of citizenship status for themselves and for their families as they are in our public schools. According to 2021 estimates from the American Immigration Council, more than 16.7 million people live in mixed status households that include at least one undocumented member. Approximately 6 million of the people in those households are younger than 18 years of age, so are children. Now, we know that in the same way that mixed status family members' immigration status may be in flux, these numbers are also in flux. And so it's quite possible that these numbers are much larger today. Most of the children who grew up in mixed status families are US-born citizens, and the oldest siblings tend to be undocumented minors who have come to the United States with their parents, caregivers, or sent with someone, a trusted adult. And so this book focuses on six students from Mexico, from El Salvador, and from the Dominican Republic, whose experiences shine a light on a much broader phenomenon taking place in the United States today. Now, I want to take us into an ethnographic vignette, if we could call it that, a vignette from Knowing Silence. And it's a vignette that really exemplifies three core themes of the book. So the three core themes are, one, that children know about the significance of citizenship status in their mixed status families. Children are not innocent or unaware of these realities. They know about them and they inform the ways that they act at school and at home. The second core theme is that immigration policy shapes the educational experiences of kids and adults. So they're not distinct spheres of policy. They intersect every day in the lives of children and families in public schools. And the third core theme of the book is that children tell us what they know about immigration status, both in what they say and in what they write, and also through what they don't say and what they choose not to write. And so the title of the book, Knowing Silence, is suggestive of this ethnographic finding, right? That children know about citizenship's significance, and they know so much about what it means that they know when and when not to disclose, and they know when and when not to disguise the realities that they and their families live with. So come with me into a fifth grade classroom in Brooklyn, New York. This is one of the examples at the heart of the book. And on this day, the children in fifth grade and in this immigrant neighborhood, largely Latinx, diasporic neighborhood school. In this school, on this day in 2014, the children were asked to define the word diversity. So the teacher gave them post-it paper, different colored markers, and the children were asked to create a word web. For those of us in education, we can imagine right away it means a circle at the center of the page with a word in it, with radiating lines and other circles. And the children were asked to put diversity in the center, and then add other words that came to mind as they were thinking about the word diversity. One child at the heart of this study held the marker. Different ideas came up: skin color, language, culture. And a few turns into this exchange, I had an audio recorder in the small group. And so it was capturing the conversation that was unfolding. A few turns into the conversation, the same child is writing down the words, and a peer of hers says, border. because some people crossed the border and some people didn't. And at this moment, the child with the marker, who I knew, because as an ethnographer, I knew that this child was undocumented. No one else in the classroom knew. The teacher didn't know. That child said, chill, I'm not writing nothing. I'm not putting anything. I'm not writing anything down. And refused to enter into the record of that word web border because some people crossed and some people didn't. And so as an ethnographer, I could go back to that exchange over and over and listen to it. And something that went so quickly, passed so quickly by in classroom interaction, I was able to return to. And what I realized is that that child in that moment, and that child in many other moments in their schooling, had to make these real-time decisions. What am I going to write down? What am I not going to write down? What conversations am I willing to get into? Which ones do I shy away from? It mattered that this child didn't say. And it mattered that this child said she wouldn't write because the topic coming up in school, she knew was too risky to broach. I wonder what you all could think through with me about this ethnographic vignette. What's the significance of this child choosing to be a very active participant in school in some ways, write down culture and language and be a grade A student, an honor student, but then also know when not to write and when not to say. So I'll pause. It's an offering, this ethnographic vignette. What do we make of that child's behavior, decision-making, and conciencia, once again, consciousness, awareness in that moment?
You know, while you were sharing that story, I kind of got like tears in my eyes because it reminded me of me in my childhood. I feel like it's a lot more so like fear of judgment, fear of like being less than everyone else in a sense. Even as a child, like, you know, you're different and you don't want to put yourself out there as being less than everyone else. And those are like my words because that's kind of how I felt. You know, growing up in an immigrant household, my parents always was like, never share this because people are going to think of you a certain way. It was a thing not to say, not to share to the public. Either they're going to call immigration on you, they're going to take you away. It was just more so like fear. And it was never something to share ever. And as a person that crossed the border for days and was taken away from my parents and put up for adoption and gone through the whole thing, I feel like me knowing that as a child kind of made me even more of a fear to kind of like share it with others. But as an adult, my mindset kind of changed. I feel like it's important to kind of like shine on being different and how impactful you could be to these students as an adult. Like, it's okay to share and nothing is going to happen to you. So I think the child part of me or of that child is the fear and scared of like what ifs. And then as the adult, knowing the fact that that kind of like drifts and changes of the ifs are okay, it's safer. And also the time period, I feel like it's different. You know, when I was younger, the fear was stronger, I guess, in a sense. And I feel like as the time period went on and, you know, I did become having DACA and I did have like, all these laws came out, it was a little bit more safer to kind of say and speak up a little bit. But I do hear this child and I totally understand of not wanting to put that shine on him of being different.
I kind of wanted to add on of the emotions. I feel like it's not only fear, but it's also a sense of privacy as like a child and not necessarily being undocumented or documented. There's a lot of things of your own self that you don't know if it's okay to share because everyone is relating to it, if everyone has done it. And mainly in this scenario where like we're speaking about diversity and to everyone it's different. I can say something about myself, my culture that I think everyone can relate to, but once it's something that I'm not so sure, it's more of like they might ask me questions. Maybe I know something they don't, and just them asking me questions would make me feel uncomfortable and put me in a situation where now not only am I not comfortable because I just spoke about something or I just wrote something, but now I have other like students or my classmates asking me these questions, and a lot of undocumented students feel uncomfortable sharing.
Yeah, thank you, Claudia and Lumari, for your like testimonials there. I I guess I would be curious to hear from you all, like, or maybe get some clarification too, Ariana, around when you heard this comment. Was it kind of like a soft comment? Was it something that other people heard or just you?
Thank you. Thank you, Aurora. I love that question because one of the things I didn't talk about yet was the methodology for this work, right? And I'm a person who loves children and listens to children. And one of the ways in which I listen to them is by recording what they say. And so in the case of this project, and it's, you know, expanded upon at length in the book, one of the methodologies was to ask the focal children, as it were, to wear iPod touches, which had voice memo apps, which allowed for long stretches of naturally occurring talk, as we call it in the field, right? And so what it permitted me was the opportunity to go back to things that in a normal classroom interaction of 25 to 30 children are fleeting, are completely ephemeral, that come and go in a matter of seconds, and that often go unnoticed. I will say that by listening to the recording, no one else skipped a beat, right? The child said under their breath, very low, chill, chill, I'm not putting that, I'm not writing nothing, I'm not going to write that. And the other children went on talking, sort of free associating. It went from border to independence, which I thought was interesting, then circled back to other topics. The child themselves, the one with the marker, after saying they weren't going to write anything, came back around and introduced a completely different subject, games, and tried to redirect the conversation away from the question of immigration. So I'd love to know what you think now that I've given a little more context about that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it makes a huge difference, right? Because I was going to ask all of you, like, what, as teachers, what would you do if you had heard that comment, or if it was said, like, in a louder voice or whatnot? Because I think those are such pivotal moments, right, in the classroom that can go south or can really be a really great teaching moment. So yeah, I mean, and personally, you know, I don't relate as much because, and also, you know, I mean, I'm 50 years old. The only reason we ended up becoming documented was because of the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act. And so luck and privilege, right? Because we didn't cross the border. We took a plane from Guatemala and came on a visa and just let it expire. And so I also think it speaks to the diversity of experiences in the U.S. mindset. There's an image that comes up when you think of an undocumented person. And the truth of the matter is it is widely diverse, and that narrative serves a purpose. So yeah, but I am curious, Claudia, you said that you're an educator yourself and Maria as a student. Have you maybe had instances where you've had to navigate that kind of a situation with a student or yourself, where you've been either like called out or felt sort of some kind of way because of your status?
I mean, as an educator in my classroom, we start the year with culture and diversity. And I always share my story. I think it's very important for my students to know their teacher on a personal level. And I don't share like details, like, you know, hardship details, but I'm very honest, and I tell them who I am and how I came into this country. We read children's books based on immigration and diversity throughout the whole maybe 3 months of the school year. And I think it's more sense of having a teacher build that culture within their classroom of being comfortable. And it starts with sharing my story. You have to open up that foundation of being comfortable within your classroom and having that community sense in your classroom for students to start sharing their own thoughts and feelings and ideas. So I think that's very important. And I think that's one thing I do within my classroom. I want my students to have that foundation set for them, because as the months go by, I did have a few students that share, oh, well, I learned my parents or my grandparents were immigrants and I didn't know this. Or, oh, I started asking questions. I went back home and I shared my story to my families about you. And I learned so-and-so. So they start learning about themselves and their culture and their ethnicity. And I had a lot of parents always like email me after, like, oh my God, thank you so much for bringing these conversations into your classroom. Like, for example, I had one student and I've never had my child wanting to speak Spanish. And ever since she's now in your classroom, now she wants to speak Spanish and she wants to go on Duolingo and like learn Spanish and learn more about her culture. And she's so open to these conversations, and she feels more of a comfortable space coming into your classroom and having these, you know, strong topics being brought up and having that conversation. So I think as an educator, it's very important to set that foundation within your classroom. If I had that as a student, I would have completely been a different student. I would have completely had a different sense of community, you know, as a student. I would have never been so much like in a nutshell, so to say, and feel like I can't tell anybody about who I am, or, you know, everybody thought that I was, even my friends that I've been friends for years, they didn't find out that I was an immigrant until like I was almost closer to college. And they're like, what? You never told me this? And I was like, no, because I was always scared, right? I never had that sense of being safe, so to speak. As an educator, I think that's very important to have that, regardless of where you're from, whether it's immigration or not, but just having that sense of community and be feeling safe is important. And I want to give them that platform. Like, they could have somewhere to go. If it's not home or it's not with someone else, they could share it within their classroom.
It's really very heartwarming to know that now there's more educators like yourself. And I also know other teachers that are also from immigrant parents, or they are also immigrants, they cross borders, and they share their stories in classrooms. Honestly, I would have loved that as a child. But in my beginning years as like pre-K, kindergarten, first grade, right before even knowing that there's schools that actually do provide both languages, a lot of my teachers were just English speakers. And the only thing like they would share in as I grow up, I understand they would share like they lived in the suburbs and they had their like, I guess, the more common childhood. And I was never able to relate or have that safe space to talk about my childhood. And then everyone else was like, yeah, I had this, or I had a backyard, and I had all of these other things, which to me, I never had these things, and I never felt like I really connected with anyone. And I think growing up, that really stamped in my head that I'm not like everyone else. I am different from everyone else. And it made me feel really alone when I was younger. And growing up more into being part of a elementary school that did speak Spanish, and I enjoyed being able to speak my home language because I am able to speak both of them, but I feel more comfortable in speaking Spanish and being able to just say what I want to say in the language that I want to say it. Having all these teachers speak about like, we're all different, they're sharing either their experience, or we're reading a book and they share Mira. It's like, this person came from this other country, and I felt more comfortable growing up from there. And I started seeing like, well, there is more people that are adults like me. They are teachers. They figured out how to like live with this. And like, it kind of brought me more of a positive direction growing up. But even doing interviews for like scholarships, doing interviews for all these other things, it does still come up to the point where like, it makes me feel alone in a way. A lot of things like in my resume, there's something that can maybe resonate as like, I'm an undocumented student, and I have interviewers asking me, they're like, oh, so you were part of this program, so you're an undocumented student yourself. And they don't say it straight to you. They don't say, oh, you're undocumented, but they kind of reference it, and they either try to ask you in some way and they're like, but how are you doing this? Or how are you able to manage this? And it makes you doubt yourself. So it's very heartwarming to know that now there's a lot more educators trying to bring this like safe space.
I also wanted to add, as an educator in the school that I'm in, it's not as diverse. I think it's also important to bring these topics to students that are white, right? And privileged students, so they can learn that these people are out in the world, they exist. And, you know, I felt like growing up, I had non-Spanish friends, and they always like felt like they were better than me, right? Because they were like white, privileged, and they had like the white picket fence. And I'm more in like a 2-bedroom apartment with a larger family. It wasn't the same lifestyle. So I feel like bringing these conversations and having other students understand the concepts of different types of families and culture, I feel like it's very important. Me growing up being a Mexican undocumented person and having like a white friend, for example, was very challenging. Like, I always felt not part of their world, so to speak. now as an educator, I'm bringing up all these cultures and diversity and different types of living situations or foods and just bringing this into life. I feel like they're like so curious and they're so more respectful to other people, you know, in the world. And I'm like, you know, you are the future. And it makes me feel like I'm guiding them to the right direction of giving them a light of like, okay, well, we're all here and we're all trying to be better and we're all the same.
I just wanted to add on that that would actually be so great if everyone did, because it takes the weight off personally me of having to educate my friends or having to educate anybody that doesn't know and having them ask me all these questions and reminding me that I can't do this or I have to go through all this process to just do something that you could just apply for. Or you can just sign up your name and you can do it. And I have to go through all these like loopholes, and they start giving you this emotion of like, oh, but like, I'm so sorry you're not able to do this. And it's just like, I don't want the empathy, or I don't need that. It's like, I'm not defenseless. I'm all right with telling you I am undocumented, but I don't want to be seen as I'm defenseless, or I don't acknowledge the things, or I don't know what in what position I am myself. And having to educate them and tell them and repeat everything again, it's very tiring and it's very frustrating. A lot of people don't know. And I don't know, it could be either like they weren't educated about it and also like not wanting to be able to learn about it.
I agree.
I want to return to a few key words that I've heard throughout this conversation that are also words that appear in the book and that I think are a testament to these last few words, the strength, the not being defenseless. We could link up to the undocumented and unafraid movement, which I think is so much a part of that shift, Claudia, that you described over time. Of there really being a social movement for immigrant justice and immigrant rights in this country. Part of that strength, part of that unafraidness, that not defenselessness, is also a reckoning with these sort of three ideas that I want to braid together from what I've been hearing. This uncertainty, Lomari, that you raised for us earlier, this sense of privacy because of an uncertainty about being judged for one's self-worth, right, that Claudia, you mentioned, and also the importance of narratives. Aurora, you mentioned testimonio or testimony, a narrative, right? That is a speaker's individual narrative that links up to a broader political reality and sense of movement building at a social level. And so I want to say a few things and then again offer up an opportunity for you all to respond. But, you know, one of the things that comes up in the book and that Aurora's work has really been fundamental to my work then in this area has been this notion of self-worth as linked to papers. And the notion, if I may, of hyper-documentation that Aurora has really advanced for us in the field, and thinking about how in the absence of immigration status, so papers that come from the government that really are about demarcating who belongs in the country, in the society, and who has ownership of the nationality, as it were, in the absence of that kind of paper, then what Aurora has found in her work has been that there is a desire then to accumulate educational papers that can then shore up a person, an individual, a family sense of self-worth, the accumulation of diplomas, of other kinds of documents that compensate for the nation state's withholding of a kind of immigration paper, right? So there's that, right? If we pause to consider that, and then that phenomenon is taking place for families, for children, for caregivers and parents in the face of political uncertainty. So then if we turn to think about DACA, which you raised for us, Claudia, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that Barack Obama signed in into practice in 2012, in the absence of a broader immigration reform that would have granted citizenship to undocumented individuals, we have the DACA program, but it has also been under a state of tremendous uncertainty itself as a policy since Donald Trump became president, right? And so for young people like Lumari, who I've known since they were 10 years old, imagine a fifth grader, right? That same fifth grader in that classroom, one of the peers in that word web activity who grew up aware of the existence of DACA and spent their childhood thinking, well, when I turn 15, right? Because 15 was the golden age at which one could become eligible for DACA, and that young people, what I do in this project, would say, when I turn 15, I'll be able to apply for DACA and I'll be able to change my status and have access to new degrees of integration socially, economically, educationally. Well, when they turned 15, Donald Trump was president. And so from 15 to now 20, 21 years of age, they have been wondering how now they will be able to access the kind of economic educational opportunity that they had spent the last 10 years hoping to obtain. Those desires then for belonging in multiple domains of life have remained very uncertain and have circled back to that question of self-worth and to that question of welcome and of belonging here in this country. And then finally, to circle back to Aurora's point about narratives serving a purpose. And so the book, Knowing Silence, argues for an approach to listening to children because their narratives matter, right? And because we, as educators, professors, researchers, policymakers, more broadly, we grown-ups in the field of education ought to listen in to what children have to say and ought to listen closely enough to also perceive what they don't say, but that these narratives serve a purpose so that we can work in solidarity with young people in mixed status homes, and also so that we can be critical of narratives that serve us poorly. So, for example, the narrative that has attached to DACA has been part of different moments in which undocumented people have been given access to rights in this country. We can look at DACA as an example. We can look at Plyler versus Doe, the 1982 Supreme Court case that gives all children the right to public schooling in this country, regardless of their or their caregivers' immigration status. At each point, those increased opportunities or those policies or those decisions have been argued on the basis of deservingness. And they have reproduced a different kind of narrative, right? A narrative in which some immigrants are deserving of these privileges, namely students, namely children, primarily not those who come alone without families, men who labor, right? We can look at Carla Villavicencio's book, The Undocumented Americans, for a really, you know, a pointed critique. We can look at the New York State Youth Leadership Council for a really astute sense of leadership in terms of what terms they use to describe themselves, undocumented, not dreamers, right? Because they don't want to reproduce a narrative in which just a few can aspire or just a few can be granted access. I wonder as we circle back then to thinking about strength, to think about being undocumented and unafraid, to not being defenseless. How do we reconcile, or how do you think with me, think together with us about this connection between these ongoing dilemmas of self-worth, the messages that are transmitted, received in the society about who belongs, who doesn't, the policy and political uncertainty that then impacts a sense of confidence, of belonging, of possibility, and then this question of narratives and the kind of narratives that you tell about yourselves, about those you love and care about in your everyday life?
Well, the first thing that came to mind when you mentioned DACA and turning 15, and automatically it was like a month before I turned 15, they were like, DACA closed, no more applications, everybody that was already in it, that's it. And it was really devastating, mainly for my parents. Even though I knew that I was building up for that moment, it wasn't so much in my head because I knew automatically I'm like elementary school, I'm going to go to middle school, I'm going to go to high school. And always as like a child, I was like, I don't know how I'm going to make it to go to college, but I'm going to go to college somehow, some way. When everything came to be like the news, DACA's not a thing anymore for me. It was very heartbreaking. It was very like my support system was really the one that kind of pulled me back up and telling me, my mom was like, but you did this. You've been an honor roll for this. So she was like, it's okay. Like whatever is to come, you're going to be part of that group. And whenever they give some type of documentation or they give some type of program, they usually always choose students or they choose anyone that could and excel in this like country in some way, somehow have a career of some sort. So she would always tell me, keep going, keep doing what you're doing, like focus in school. Don't focus on like outside of like news and stuff. It's a lot of self-worth and being able to say like, what's it really for? I'm working all this like way, I'm doing all of these steps, I'm coming across a lot of things that it's hard for me. It's hard for me to study, or it's hard for me to pass this class and all of these things. But I'm like, I have to push myself harder because I can't be like all the other students. I can't afford to just be like, well, it's just high school or it's just middle school. It's okay. I always have to stand out from everyone else and stand out in a way that I also wasn't standing out. I had to stand out academically, but I couldn't put myself to stand out as an undocumented student because I still didn't know if that space was a safe space. I'm in the uncertainty, even now, trying to pursue my career, trying to choose classes and them telling me, well, you need to be fingerprinted for this. And I can't get fingerprinted. So I'm like, well, I can't tell this to my professor as of right now, but I will probably have to go ask somewhere else or I have to go investigate somewhere else. And it just brings a lot of loops that I have to keep jumping through to do the same thing as everyone else.
I'll share the DACA part of me too. I still have all those feelings, even as a DACA recipient. Growing up, like, I didn't understand until, like, I reached high school when all my friends were, like, applying for colleges. And during that time, DACA didn't exist. And that's when I had an understanding. I'm like, wait a minute, I can't apply. That was it for me. Like, my parents said, no, you can't go to college, like, because you're an immigrant. Like, that was just the mindset that was given to me. And I was like, wait, I can't go to college. And I didn't understand it until, like, I'm like, no, there's no way that I cannot go to college because all my friends were, like, interested in becoming doctors and interested in becoming nurses. And I'm like, wait, I can't be, like, nobody. Like, I have to be somebody. That was my standard. Like, I need to be somebody important, somebody in life. So I'm like, I'm going to do it, even though I did get the support from my parents, like, okay, you could do whatever you want, but it wasn't as extreme, like, okay, college is important. Like, for them, it was more so like, you're here, you're going to work, and that's it. But for me, that wasn't it for me. I wanted something more. I wasn't in college right away. I worked for 2 years really hard because I knew I couldn't afford college. It was so expensive, and I was paying outside tuition. Even though I was here in this country before I was 1 year old, I was paying double the tuition. Instead of $1,000 for a class, I was paying $2,000-$3,000 for a class. I was considered as an out-of-state student. So I took one class or two classes at a time, depending on what I could afford. And that's how I went through. And I wasn't even sure if by the time I graduate, if I was going to be able to work in whatever I decided to become, because I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to. I don't have a social security. I can't fingerprint myself either, right? Like, even when I was like, okay, let me just do a 2-year program, I couldn't do anything because everything was like New York State and I had to like get fingerprinted. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to just stay here and take classes until I find my path. And that's when I found my path. I was like, okay, I'm going to be a teacher. But then I'm like, all right, God knows if I'm going to be able to teach or be in the classroom. And then by the time, I think like a month or two before I graduated, DACA came into place. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be able to teach. It was a good thing. But then at the same time, you know, living in with uncertainty, I'm like, I'm in my classrooms. I have my moments that sometimes I sit in my class. I'm like, wow, I'm actually here. This is my classroom. I'm actually a teacher. Sometimes I can't even believe it. But then I still live with a cloud, with a black cloud. Like, you never know when you're going to get ripped from it because it's not set in stone. I now live like, okay, I live in the moment. I'm teaching now and I'm doing everything I can, you know, as an educator and what I believe in to give the next generation the pathway and the light of what's going on in the world. But I don't know if I'm going to get ripped from it, right? So I'm just like taking it all in for the moment and just seeing what comes. And also like as a mother now for my son, and that's also a scary point. I don't know what's going to be the future. Am I going to be ripped away from my son? Like, no, he's not going to come with me. And so all these unknown questions I still live with, and it's always going to stay with me until something happens. Just having the DACA just feels temporary. And I just have to like live with it and embrace what I have now, because you don't know if it's going to be gone tomorrow.
You all are reminding me of a couple of things. One is, as you both were talking, I was thinking about Roberto Gonzalez's book, Lives in Limbo. I think it's called Undocumented and Coming of Age. But he talks about this feeling of just like a perpetual limbo. I also thought about something else, which is Tara Yoso's concept of community cultural wealth, where she talks about like what we normally see as wealth, like capital, is sort of aligned with like whiteness or citizens or class. And she counters that and says, actually, Latinx folks how there's six types. The only reason I remember is because I gave a presentation about this yesterday. It was resistant capital, navigational capital, linguistic capital, familial capital, social capital, and aspirational capital. And one of the things I heard you all say was the aspirational capital, which is this idea of like, it's like you're in limbo, and yet you still have such high expectations and hope and aspirations and dreams. And I'm wondering how you all manage the day-to-day. When I studied with undocumented students, you know, they talked a lot about their mental health. And so I'm just wondering, what are some things that you all do to keep yourself together, grounded, hopeful, sometimes just surviving? But yeah, I'm curious to hear, like, what do you all do on a daily basis to navigate this space?
As of right now, like one of my classes, I wasn't able to do the field work that every other student is supposed to do with like children in an after school program. And I'm working in like the office, and I'm helping with like the marketing part, and I'm helping with more of the organization part because I can't get fingerprinted. So what I set my mind to is like, well, I can't put I did field work with students in my resume, but I could put I have experience doing marketing. I have experienced managing program or managing and organizing events for this program. I could put like all these other things that I could keep adding up. I tell myself, okay, maybe it's not a set thing that I have, but it's a small thing and it'll keep adding up. That's what I've been telling myself since like high school and high school as well, which it was so much easier to be part of so many programs in high school. I was part of the scholars program, which I was able to take classes in the new school, which is an art school. And I really fell in love with the art and being able to participate in all of these like events. I was able to go to exhibits and I was opened to a lot more people, a lot more conversations, a lot more opportunities, because now I know I can go to galleries. I enjoy going to galleries. I enjoy making things at home. I do charcoal paintings. So a lot of these things in my head were like, yeah, I'm going to school, but I'm also doing all these other small stuff. I'm not doing nothing. I have to keep doing other stuff. I have to keep putting myself to do things that I can do and just keep adding it up. And that's how I keep myself more stable, I guess, and like mentally stable when it comes to my academics. And then more of my personal life, it's more of like, my support system. My parents are very close to me. My sister, we're always like having dinner together and we have these conversations and we always talk about like my parents are always like, well, it's okay. You know, you are studying, you're going well, just keep going. Words of encouragement do help, as well as personal hobbies. I recently started getting into like new series of reading books and I do art by myself, as well as like keeping open my connections in way of like, I speak with Miss Ariana all the time and I speak with my friends or I speak with like other people that I have uncertainty. Like I'm part of the Macaulay Honor Scholarship. There's some people I feel comfortable speaking with. And sometimes I'm like, well, I'm not so comfortable speaking with this person, but I know I can ask this other person. And I try to be like, well, can I do this? Having to keep asking or having to keep talking, and hopefully something will come up into the conversation and I'll be like, oh, how can I be part of that? It's community service that I get to do a lot of the things, and I do enjoy it. And it's also very hard to be like, well, I can't apply to regular internships and get paid for it. I'm at least getting the experience. I'm trying not to like stay in one place, because if I stayed in one place, then it would be a completely different story.
I guess for me, before I was an educator and before I was a mom, I did go into like a dark place. You know, I was depressed, you know, especially because I didn't have sources outside knowing other people that were in the same predicament as me. I didn't have people to talk to or share my experiences with. So that was really hard. But it was more so like that. Like I am an artist. So I used to always be drawing or reading, or just keeping myself busy and just being hopeful. I don't think I ever let go of that, being hopeful. It's gonna happen eventually. And then now as an educator, I think my classroom is my safe haven. I'm like, okay, I'm here. I'm gonna do everything that I have in me to do what I'm supposed to be doing for the future. My students and my classroom is what keeps me going. And then my son, more so now for him to grow up and understand like the struggles, and well, he was born here and he's going to have a lot more opportunities and he's going to be a lot more privileged than I was. But I don't want him to lose that sense of who he is and who where his parents came from. So I'm always bringing back things from my own culture and bringing him up knowing and speaking Spanish and doing everything that I did as a child.
Now, one of the goals of the book, Knowing Silence, is to help adults in the field of education break their own professional silences around the very real lived experiences we're talking about today. The book argues, right, that because of the important and inclusive policies that have taken hold in education over the years, particularly since 1982, the Plyler Supreme Court decision that has then become educational policy that protects students' rights to schools, elementary, middle, and high school, as Domari reminded us, because of policies like DACA, it was possible to not talk about, as educators, not talk about students' immigration status. In fact, not only is it possible, it's actually often required that teachers never inquire about their students' immigration status for important reasons. Now, what it means, I think, in terms of our professional dispositions, behaviors, norms, is that the ways that we protect students' rights to schooling is by erasing, invisibilizing their immigration status. It's a don't ask, don't tell policy, essentially, right? So educators are required not to ask, precisely out of questions of privacy, precisely out of questions of not putting anyone at risk. But by not asking, it can lead us to assume that these issues don't exist then, right? Either that children are too young to know, or that what happens outside of school stays outside of school and doesn't impact children's experiences in the classroom. Everything that you all are talking about points to the contrary, right? That an immigrant in this country carries that immigrant identity with them, and in a diverse way, as Aurora pointed out to us, diversity in how immigrants came, diversity in different immigration statuses. It should also be said diversity beyond Latinx communities, that this question of immigration status, schooling, impacts racialized, ethnic, national origin communities from very different places across the world. But nonetheless, the point being that as educators, then we can assume that children don't know about the realities of immigration status, and actually that we can feel bound never to ask in order to protect students' rights. The impact that I see this have on graduate students in CUNY, at the Graduate Center where I'm a professor, in the lives of the young people in this project, who I'm still in very good touch with today, is that students themselves, families, parents themselves, have to them take the risk to disclose their own immigration status in order to advocate for new opportunities. But if we go back to the statistics that we started the conversation with, that more than 16.7 million people live in mixed status households as of 2021, with at least one undocumented member, that approximately 6 million of the people in mixed status households are younger than 18 years of age, then shouldn't we always assume that we have an undocumented student in our class? Or shouldn't we always assume that we need to tailor our conversations about accessing an internship, about applying for financial aid, about the books we bring into our classroom libraries? Shouldn't we always be thinking about how to have pathways for young people that are inclusive, right? Without waiting for them to have to take the risk, come to office hours, tell their stories. And in light of our beautifully and complicatedly ongoing migration of people across the world and into the United States and back out into home countries and new countries of residence, shouldn't we always be prepared to receive and to welcome and to have these conversations? And so I think the answer is yes. The book certainly argues that part of what we need to do is gain practice in these conversations. These are hard conversations to have. And certainly for any educators who are not directly impacted, they're very hard conversations. It requires imagining un otro ser, another self. It requires learning a history that one may not have lived personally, and it requires a sense of love and commitment to listening and learning from one another. So I wonder what you all think about this question about what and how teachers can go about breaking their professional silences, educators and researchers, policymakers, breaking our own professional silences, going beyond the don't ask, don't tell policies that we uphold in public schools, to think in new ways about how to serve our students all, and our students immigrant and our students from mixed status families, without putting the onus on those students to take risks to access equitable educational opportunities. So what do we need to do? How could we get more fluent in this kind of practice so that we go beyond the silences that exist today and so that we break our professional silences very much in the spirit of the book and its goals for our colleagues and ourselves?
I think we have to stay away from categorizing that there's two types of children, children that are not immigrants or that have no idea about it, and children that don't. Even if they know or they don't know, or if they have family members that are immigrants coming into the country or just came or they themselves came, say, well, everybody has to know. Maybe it doesn't affect their life, but they know their cousin, their aunts, all these people that they interact with in the daily basis. I think that a lot of teachers don't have to ask to help. It could be from a book. It could be a shared experience. It could be from any way starting. I think it's not the hardest part. I think it's more keep it going and making sure that everyone is understanding these topics. Everyone is asking these questions, because maybe a student that is undocumented won't ask these questions, but because children are children, children are curious, children will ask questions and be like, what does this mean? Or how does that work? And not necessarily not only children, teenagers and everything. I feel like now we've come to a time where we all want to know about everything. We all want to know how we can help. We all want to be aware. At least most of us do want to be more aware, want to be educated with all these other topics, and also want to be advocates for our friends, for our family members. So just starting and not making sure that, you know, you don't have to ask to help. You don't have to put anyone outside or make them stand out. You just have to kind of bring it out there and start showing all these different strategies. This is information, do with it as you please. It's for everyone. It's not categorizing anybody, not putting anyone in any sort of group, just saying, well, these are things that we can all do to help, or we can all learn from. And this would also help students like me having to teach other students like me things that they don't know, and having to take as well that weight off personally my shoulders of having to educate everyone else. In that scenario, everyone would know by then. And it would be like, oh, but like, I heard this from someone. Have you tried this? Or have you done this? Or it's just so much more helpful in conversations.
I think, like, as a teacher, like, you know, setting that, like I said before, that safe space inside the classroom and just being undocumented, like bringing my story into play. But I also feel like a lot of teachers don't know where to start. It's not firsthand experience. So they feel uncomfortable, or they're not Hispanic or not Latinx, and they're, you know, white teachers, they like don't want to touch it because they're not like, I'm not sure. Like, and instead of saying I'm not sure or I don't know where to start, maybe seek out to those that do know. Like, I was very open, like with my community and my school, that I'm undocumented. Maybe not everyone knows, but we had small meetings. And, you know, in the beginning of the school year, they ask questions like in small groups, like, who are you? How you identify? And that's how certain people in small groups started learning like who I was. And I became more open. And I feel like it's important as an educator for other educators to know, like, you have this person within your community that you could reach out to in case you have anyone within your classroom that you're not sure how to bring up conversations. Like, not asking directly, but bringing in books, resources. You know, working with adults is a little bit more trickier than with children. And I feel like you just have to be very open. And that's something very hard for me, since I was always shut off of who I was. Don't share, don't tell kind of thing. As an educator, I learned how important it is. And sharing to other people in the world as educators is important. And maybe like bringing up a curriculum or having smaller group settings, like the way they do like in staff meetings, right? But in a bigger sense, I think if it was brought up, like, Claudia, do you want to share who you are? I think everyone would be like, oh, wow, I didn't know Claudia is an undocumented teacher. Wow, she could have been a great resource for this student. So I feel like me not doing that, it kind of takes away from the kids that needed the support. And that's where I feel always like, oh no, maybe I should share. Or, you know, and I try to have different conversations with people throughout the building. So then I could kind of tell them my story. And they're like, oh, wow, I didn't know. Well, this is how, you know, you could communicate with this person. And that's how I got in touch with a lot of people that were sharing the same experiences with me. If I don't share it, I feel like it's not heard. I don't know, how can I share that light on the fact that this is who I am, and I could definitely be like a resource for other teachers to navigate these conversations into their classrooms?
Well, it is my hope that this book, Knowing Silence, How Children Talk About Immigration Status in School, can serve as an example of listening to children, of recognizing their strength and the strength of the population of children growing up in mixed status families today, and that it helps to take the responsibility off of any one person from disclosing, of any one person from bearing the responsibility for educating others about their very real lived experiences that children, adolescents, adults live with in this country when they live without documentation, without U.S. citizenship, or in mixed status families. And as the book travels, I hope that the voices of the six children, the teachers who have been part of this project over years, that the voices of the children and of the teachers travel as well. And that through that traveling of voices, others of us can break our professional silences and work together in solidarity with immigrant students, with students from mixed status families, and share the responsibility of educating ourselves and one another so we can continue to work towards justice for immigrants in the United States and educational opportunities for the children who are growing up in this country with the richness of the many countries of origin, languages, immigration status that they bring to our classrooms and schools throughout the country. So I thank you so much for sharing of yourselves, of your experiences, of your work, of your careers with us today, Aurora, Claudia, and Lumari. Over the length of this book, you have been central to the project, and I hope that we will continue to be able to have these conversations and many more, and that the conversations grow within the field of education more broadly.